the Battle of Britain had begun.
It was radar that first gave warning of the coming storm. Warning of an enemy armada assembling in the Pas de Calais. The wires started to hum, wires that led to every gun sight and airfield in southern England. As yet, the enemy was but a pattern on the radar screen, a symbol on the plotting table. But these things told us that this was the biggest thing yet.
During this desperate period, the design team and engineers at Salisbury Hall doggedly carried on with the construction of the prototype in a hangar disguised as a barn behind the house.
The site was disguised as a farm building area, or at least an agricultural area, and I'm sure that people on the buses as they went past the gate and stopped nearby were wondering why farm workers were apparently coming out to work on the night shift. The security of the site was never compromised while the Mosquitoes were being built here, even though a German spy landed about 2 miles away by parachute, but he was soon captured. In fact, within 24 hours, he was in jail.
Team started working in earnest.
She was covered with tarpaulins to hide her form from frequent German raiders. The technicians liked the look of her very much. A few straight hops and off she went on her first flight. She was a joy to behold. She looked right. And she was right.
The 45-minute test flight was a resounding success. And as the flight test program progressed, the results of this filtered back to Whitehall. Any qualms they had about the validity of the project dissipated. The ministry's newfound enthusiasm for the project was backed by orders for quantity production. The de Havilland factory at Hatfield soon became only one of the centers involved in mass construction.
The main bomber production line was at Hatfield, and the main fighter bomber production line was at Leavesden, with other fighter bombers produced at Standard Motors, and bombers produced at Luton, and later on at Chester and Christchurch. I'm standing in front of the Mosquito prototype, which is the only World War II combat aircraft to be preserved anywhere in a museum in the world. This aeroplane has essentially changed very little in terms of the final design. De Havilland's really got it right first time. The aeroplane we have here has had modifications on the underside where you can see on the access door there's a clear circle panel and another one in the bomb bay on the bomb door which were used for photographic reconnaissance trials, still as an unarmed aeroplane. On the engine cowlings, this aeroplane is fitted with the flame damper exhaust covers, used on the night fighters so that the airplane would not show up quite so well in the dark, and also it helped shield the flames from the exhaust from the crew who needed to maintain good night vision. The prototype also was unique in having leading edge slats on the wings, which were not used in production, and this is the only aeroplane to have them, and they are now locked in a closed position. Another thing about this aeroplane, which shows how easy it is to repair a wooden aircraft and how tough they can be, on the fuselage there is an irregular patch. What actually happened was that the tail wheel got caught in a rut during its trial program at Boscombe Down, and it split the woodwork. And the chief designer, R.E. Bishop, went down to Boscombe, got out his chalk, and he drew around a pattern and said to the guys, make a patch to that shape which will do for the repair. It was painted yellow so that it was distinctive and was really shown as a prototype, because an unfamiliar aeroplane flying around during the early part of World War II could well have been considered by the gunners as a hostile aeroplane and might well have been a useful target.
The wooden airframe facilitated subcontracting. Any firm with woodworking experience was pressed into service. A furniture manufacturer and a school desk builder made wings. A piano maker and a coffin manufacturer supplied sections of fuselage. Smaller components were built in assorted workshops and even garden sheds. This dispersal prevented enemy air raids from disrupting production. With construction well underway, testing and development continued. Gradually, the remarkable qualities of the aircraft became apparent. Stress engineers tested wooden components to destruction.
My name is Ralph Hare, and I was working on the design of this Mosquito here at Salisbury Hall from October 1939 until we moved back to Hatfield in April 1942. I have in my hand here a piece of fuselage shell which consists of two thin skins of birch plywood supported by the light filling, which is balsa wood. Now, the big advantage of this arrangement is that the skins, if not supported in this way, would under load buckle either by compressive forces or by shearing forces, and that buckling would limit the strength of the plywood to something very much smaller than this panel represents. Now, I have compared the efficiency of the Mosquito structure with an equivalent metal design using the information we had when we designed the Flamingo. And what I find is that in most respects, the Mosquito design is superior to the metal equivalent. And had the design been continued in metal, it would have been a heavier weight aeroplane.
It was found that the wing skins could withstand a loading of 41 tons on each side. In layman's terms, the wing could carry the weight of 700 men. Because this strength was mainly in the skin, only minimal internal bracing was required, allowing the airframe to be lighter and smaller. First, the bulkheads were fixed into slots in the mould. Then, the 2mm skin of birch plywood was applied. An interlayer of balsa was then added to act as a stabiliser. Finally, on went the outer layer of ply. The whole construction was then bonded and cramped with steel clamps.
This is known as carapace, or lobster shell construction. And like a lobster, the fuselage is served up in halves, a fact which greatly facilitates the installation of equipment, controls, bonding, hydraulic, pneumatic, and electric lines.
The undercarriage struts contained columns of rubber blocks, an imaginative and simple solution which negated the need for more complicated hydraulics. The slender profile of the Merlin engines with their radiators built into the wings preserved the pure aerodynamic form. The design incorporated propellers that could be feathered that would prevent a damaged engine from windmilling. The flight trials, which are made up of 79 flights, were completed in 3 months. They confirmed the designer's predictions that the Mosquito would be as fast as a fighter. In fact, it was faster. At that time, it was the fastest aircraft in the world. It was originally designed to take 4 250-pound bombs. The designers concluded that there was so much latitude in the power-to-weight ratio that by shortening the fin on the standard 500-pound bomb, 4 of these could be carried, thereby doubling the bomb load. With British cities under nightly attack, a night fighter version was pressed forward. Here, the bombs were replaced by 4 20-millimeter cannon, augmented by 4 machine guns in the nose, giving very concentrated and destructive firepower. For the first time in aviation history, a bomber had turned into a fighter.
May the 15th, 1941, from a 450-yard field beside its secret hangar in the country, the fighter prototype made its first takeoff.
By this time, preparations for mass production were also being made in Canada. The first Mosquito entered service with the RAF in July 1941, and 3 months later, it made its first operational sortie. This was a photo reconnaissance mission over enemy harbors. Its range and its ability to fly fast at high altitude allowed Allied intelligence to be gathered from the whole of occupied Europe. By December, the RAF had 20, and by March, 50, comprising of bombers, fighters, and reconnaissance aircraft. The wooden construction had another positive attribute. Most battle damage could be repaired using simple carpentry techniques. A wingtip, for example, could be taken from stock and attached with a simple butt joint. As the war progressed, the Mosquito was continuously developed.
My name is Ian Thurston, and I'm the curator of film here at the RAF Museum at Hendon. I'd like to show you some rare archive film of Mosquitoes, which to my knowledge has never been seen before. This sequence depicts the Canadian Mosquito bomber production line at Downtown, Toronto. The first Canadian-built Mosquito flew in September 1942, initially using English parts and equipment. These are Mosquito Mark 25s. Which were fitted with American-built Packard Merlin engines. The initial batch did actually have English equipment within them, but eventually it was all changed over to Canadian-built home equipment. American national pride was injured by the introduction of the Mosquito because they did not possess an aeroplane with a comparable performance. Indeed, an early Canadian Mosquito was delivered for trials at the American Research Centre at Wright Field. The Canadian test pilot walked into the hangar one day to find 2 piles of sawdust beneath the aircraft with a notice in the front saying, "Warning, termites at work." The Americans were later convinced of the Mosquito's virtues.
Due to its ability to outperform enemy fighters, losses were comparatively small. The crews responded with total dedication to their aircraft. The pilots even found that by polishing their machines, they could gain a further 15 knots and reduce their fuel consumption.
Pilots could see that the best way to use such speed and maneuverability was to fly in at rooftop height, where neither ground nor...
Thank you.
15 Mosquitoes of No. 2 Group, 2nd Tactical Air Force, attacked a large school at Eglinton, in which 300 German troops were holding out against the Mackens.
Attacks on enemy headquarters and similar targets were carried out during July and August by Mosquitoes of No. 2 Group, 2nd Tactical Air Force. These attacks were made with great precision and invariably surprised the enemy by the speed and accuracy with which they were carried out.
The Mosquitoes' rugged design and maneuverability made it ideal for low-level bombing. Elite squadrons were formed, which quickly became known for their precision attacks. Flying at rooftop height, neither ground guns nor German radio detection equipment could concentrate upon them. This confusion was further heightened by flight planners plotting zigzag routes which would fool enemy fighter cover. In fact, its superb flying characteristics made it suitable for some of the most daring low-level raids of the war, including strikes on Gestapo headquarters and the famous Amiens prison raid.
Amiens jail, over 100 French patriots awaited execution. The RAF came to their rescue. One Mosquito squadron was to breach the walls. A second was to destroy the parts of the building where the German guards were housed. Group Captain Picard led the attack. An RAF film unit cameraman went along to take pictures. After takeoff, the weather was appalling. It snowed hard. But as the Mosquitoes crossed the French coast, the weather cleared. The aircraft made their attack. Afterwards, the camera Mosquito took these pictures. One of the most exacting attacks of the war had succeeded. The walls had been breached, many Germans had been killed, over 100 French patriots had joined their friends outside. But the Mosquito carrying Picard and his navigator Broadley did not return to base. Since that day, Group Captain Picard has been found in an unmarked grave near his last target.
By the spring of 1943, the Mosquito was entering service in ever-increasing numbers. The distinctive sound of the twin Merlin engines could be heard 24 hours a day as Mosquitoes set course for targets all over Europe.
Since time immemorial, has been one of the most valuable weapons of war. It is not so very long ago since the mightiest fleets of the world were built from wood, just sea-going trees, in fact. But if somebody told you that these fallen giants would soon be winging their way across the channel to blast Germany's war machine, you'd probably think he was a little gun in the head. Nevertheless, just as in the past Britain put wood to sea, so today she puts it in the air. Canadian factories, as in Britain, the transformation takes place. Wood is being shaped and given wings to fly. Slowly but surely, trees are turning into aeroplanes. Aeroplanes made entirely of wood that have, in all-round performance, beaten anything yet built. Perhaps you've guessed their identification. They started as night fighters, but have done practically every type of work. Terrific speed made them ideal for photo reconnaissance. Terrific power allowed them to carry loads equal to bombers twice their size. I expect you've all guessed what they are by now. But for those still in doubt, Mosquitoes the name. Just flying trees. It's a fact.
On March 16, the railway and industrial centre of Würzburg was the object of a night attack by Bomber Command.
The Allied heavy bombing campaign was stepped up in the second half of the war. Although these aircraft were successfully penetrating enemy airspace, they weren't necessarily hitting their targets. Indeed, on some occasions, they didn't even hit the right town. Highly trained aircrew and valuable aircraft were being sacrificed, and often the effect on the enemy was less than impressive. Bomber Command were increasingly worried about this problem, and it was in the solution to this that the Mosquito played possibly its most important role, that of Pathfinder.
Reg Davey and I'm sitting in a B-35 Mosquito. It is slightly different from the Mosquitoes I flew in on pathfinding duties. The nose of our aircraft was completely blacked out and filled with radar gear and aerials, and we dropped our target indicators completely on dead reckoning and radar. Flying as a pathfinder demanded a very accurate degree of navigation and a very, very high degree of accurate flying on the part of the pilot, because most of our exploits were on time to the nearest second. We had a radar set in the nose, which we pulled out. That was a G-set, which could give us a fix, but about halfway across the North Sea, the Germans jammed it. And then, as we approached the enemy coast, I had an H2S radar set, which was situated behind the pilot. And this gave us a picture of the ground. It could not be jammed by the Germans. It could pick out coastlines, rivers, lakes, headlands, and the mush of a town. And this, combined with our accurate navigation, gave us our position. And we normally ran in on a certain landmark, like a lake or a little headland. As the indicators were reaching the ground, a photo flash went off and took a picture of the ground. At that time, I had to take a picture of the actual radar screen with a camera, which we had on legs, so that when we got back to our airfield, there was an analysis as to the accuracy of our dropping of the flares.
The accuracy of this marking was obviously vital to the success of the following raid. ...617 Squadron, famous for the raids on German dams, perpetuated their fame with further daring pathfinding missions as the war progressed. In fact, many famous pilots were to become associated with the aircraft during the war. It was an aeroplane that encouraged pilots to push themselves and their machines to the limits. Another one of these was John Cunningham, a night fighter pilot. He notched up such considerable success in the early part of the war that the British media nicknamed him Cat's Eyes Cunningham.
The amnesty decided to explain why I had had those by saying that I had exceptional night vision. That was not true. It was solely due to the fact that I and my radar operator had a radar set that gave us some information on the aeroplane or the target that we were following. And from that security angle, the fact that I was given incorrectly exceptional night vision did prove, I think, fairly effective in keeping people unaware that we were actually flying with radar. As a wing commander, I was appointed to command a night fighter squadron of Mosquitoes in the beginning of 1943. Before that, I had had 1 and a bit years flying the Blenheim as a night fighter, followed by 2 years with the Bow fighter. And that was the first effective night fighter that the Royal Air Force had. The Mosquito was nearly approximately 100 miles an hour faster than the Bow fighter, and it was essential that the night squadrons had a Mosquito, because in the 1942 onwards, German aircraft flying over the country at night were really going too fast for the Bow fighter. So we were very lucky to have this splendid aeroplane, perhaps the fastest aeroplane that was built during the war.
And Mosquitoes, now with improved equipment, got busy in 1943 when the enemy sent his fastest single-engine fighters to England with a puny bomb load, copying the Mosquito technique. But they failed, because our Mosquito fighters could catch these hit-and-run raiders.
On the short time that the night fighter had to catch up with fighter bombers, the Merlin engine used to run at full power and full boost for quite a long time, and really gave seldom any trouble. The only disadvantage to the Merlin installation in the Mosquito was that when you came up close behind an aircraft that you were firing at and hit it, some of the lighter weight bits and pieces would come back and would perhaps puncture the radiators which lie between the fuselage and the engine, and it was liable to lose you your coolant, and you would then have the engine boil, and you'd have to feather the engine. But the Mosquito flew extraordinarily well and would go very long distances, many hundreds of miles in some cases for the bombers, with only one engine working, and it still had a good performance. I'm sitting in a Mosquito bomber version this moment, and the Night Fighter had the same instrument panel and similar controls and layout of engine instruments, but the radar in the Night Fighter was mounted alongside the instrument panel on the right here, and my radar operator sat beside me, and so that he could lean forward and look into the radar tubes. A very effective layout for pilot and radar operator. When we got a radar contact at night, we never knew, and the ground was never able to tell us whether it was a hostile or one of our own aircraft that we were following. As a consequence, we always had to close in on whatever radar contact we were following to a point where we could identify it with our own eyes. And that meant closing in to almost vertically beneath the aircraft we were following to look up and determine from the wing plan form that we could see from beneath whether it was a German or one of our own aircraft. So one had to rely on following it to the combat with your own eyes. And that meant moving up slowly so that we were level with the target ahead of us. And when that happened, that's when you fired at it.
Nighttime nuisance bombing was another role that the Mosquito was given. Because of their speed, only 11 aircraft were lost after the first 1,000 sorties. By now, this small aircraft was carrying a medium bomber load to German cities, unarmed and without the need for a fighter escort. Even at the time, official figures suggested that it was possible for Mosquitoes, in terms of overall effectiveness, to drop 4.5 times the weight of bombs that even Britain's premier heavy bomber, the Lancaster, could manage. But Bomber Command stuck to its concept of the strategic superiority of the heavy bomber. In hindsight, a reappraisal of those policies might have saved the lives of many aircrew. It was only towards the end of the war that Mosquitoes, now equipped with 4,000 pounders, started a systematic bombing campaign led in by Mosquito Pathfinders. By the spring of 1945, Mosquitoes had delivered over 15,000 tons of high explosives.
It represented a small capital asset with a small crew, exposed to less danger because of its speed, and exposed to danger for less time.
In June 1944, when Hitler's V1 flying bomb started raining down on London and the home counties, Mosquitoes were tasked to shoot them down. Powered by a pulse jet engine, these missiles were difficult to catch. However, the Mosquitoes successfully destroyed over 600 in the first 9 weeks of the campaign.
Not surprisingly, a naval version of the Mosquito was developed for use on aircraft carriers. Very few of these airplanes were actually built because the Mosquito successor, the twin-engine de Havilland Hornet, much more adaptable for use on aircraft carriers.
After shore practice, a converted Mosquito Mark VI fighter bomber was successfully landed on HMS Indefatigable off the Scottish coast on March the 25th, 1944. It looked a practical proposition from the first. Besides the combination of increased load with high performance, there was the advantage of twin-engine security over the ocean.
This film shows some United States Army Air Force Mosquito PR-16s that were based at RAF Watton in Norfolk. The American Air Force used these for weather and photo reconnaissance, plus some cloak and dagger work, which basically involved supplying arms to agents in occupied Europe. Towards the end of the European War, with the advent of the German jets, the Americans began to supply fighter escorts to their own photo reconnaissance Mosquitoes. These were Mustang aircraft, and unfortunately they had trouble keeping up with the Mosquito because the Mosquitoes were just too fast for them.
Between January the 1st of 1945 and May the 8th of the same year, the Mosquito and Beaufighter squadrons of Coastal Command carried out over 5,000 sorties against enemy shipping. The majority of the attacks were against vessels in Norwegian waters, where the shipping routes along the coast took the place of roads and railways, carrying vital German war materials. These attacks played a crucial part in disrupting German communications in this area, and was the main reason why the German garrison in Norway surrendered to the Allies without resistance. Apart from the rockets and cannon used for this purpose, some Mosquitoes were equipped with a 57mm anti-tank weapon. This fired 6-pound shells fed by a mechanism specially designed by a cigarette vending machine manufacturer. These were fired at the rate of over 1 a second. The gun itself weighed over a ton, and its firing had to be carefully tested to ensure that it did not overstrain the wooden airframe. In this variant, over half a ton of additional armor plating was fitted to protect the crew and engines from return fire. The next development to the Mosquito's arsenal was the rocket, 8 of which could be mounted on pylons, with 4 under each wing. This rocket salvo was the equivalent to the broadside of a cruiser equipped with 6-inch guns. From June 1943 until the end of the war, fighters and fighter bombers were employed against land targets. These intruder squadrons were initially based in the UK. As the Allies' advanced intruder bases were set up in every theatre from Malta, Italy, Sardinia, and later from France, India, and even Australia. Their actions caused chaos amongst retreating enemy forces.
Officers and men of the self-termed Independent Air Force messed together. As the first Mosquito intruder outfit, this squadron has a wonderful record of kills from German aircraft to trains. Officers and sergeants help the ground crew to bomb up. Targets are chosen by the CO from various reports received, and then the crews are briefed in the usual way. The squadron termed itself the Independent Air Force because when normal intruder targets are not available, command permits them to act on their own.
Like Sir Geoffrey de Havilland, another tenacious engineer committed to the British war effort was Barnes Wallace. His famous invention of the bouncing bomb successfully destroyed 2 German dams. A later development of this weapon was designed for use with the Mosquito. It was codenamed Highball. 15 of these Highball-equipped Mosquitoes were dispatched to Australia, where they were to be used against the Japanese fleet. However, this was one Mosquito development that was never used in anger as the Second World War was brought to a sudden conclusion by the atom bomb attacks. We'll be right back.
Post-war, the Mosquito was used for a number of record-breaking flights because of its high speed and long range. This film was taken at Heathrow Airport in 1947 and shows Mickey Martin, one of the original Dambuster pilots, and Flight Lieutenant Ted Sismore, ready to board a Mosquito Mark 34 for a record-breaking flight to Cape Town, which they reached in a record time of 21 hours, 31 and a half minutes. It speaks volumes for the Mosquito in the fact that it was able to perform first-line duties in the era of a jet age. In fact, the Mosquito was in first-line service until December the 15th, 1955. The Mosquito completed its service career in a rather unglamorous role of target tug, a far cry from the initial dazzling bomber concept. The target tug Mosquitoes were painted in the silver finish with black and yellow stripes beneath the wings to denote its role as a second-line aircraft. They were finally retired in May 1963, and this film was shot to commemorate that particular occasion. After the flight past, most of the aeroplanes were sold to a film company and appeared in the film 633 Squadron. Two of them were sold to private concerns, and one of them is now the last flying Mosquito in the world, flown by British Aerospace at Chester.